In this podcast, you will learn why I'm positive most of the time, even when I'm not feeling it, how your attitude affects your outcomes in life, and how to overcome limiting beliefs.
My name is Sky, NFT survivor turned content creator.
And I'm Aiden, addicted video gamer turned content creator.
And you're listening to Kaizen, the weekly podcast where we talk about ideas, relationships, and the human condition.
Good mythical morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to do it one time because you always do it at the beginning. So now it's my turn. Today we're going to be talking about attitude, which is particularly a good subject because, Sky, I know that you are in a horrible studying season right now.
And a deep, dark place.
A deep, dark, I was going to say depression, and then I realized I shouldn't joke about that. That would be bad of me. But you need to figure out, how can I fix my attitude for this studying season? So today we're going to be answering what attitude is in the first place, what attitudes can help you have better outcomes in life, and answer the question first and foremost, which is, why am I so positive all the time, right? You might think it's just because I'm positive.
Drugs.
Yes, cocaine. No, lots and lots of cocaine. How did you know? We haven't even started the
There's
podcast.
There's no other explanation.
Yeah. I'm not as positive as you think I am all the time. I just come across, I try and be as positive as I can most of the time externally for a good reason. So let's start with answering that question, which is, I am positive most of the time because I realize that your attitude profoundly impacts your outcomes in life and other people's outcomes. And the reason for that is that your feelings, thoughts, beliefs impact your behaviors, which then impact your outcomes. So the way I like to think about it is, like, attitude is your window to the world, right? As a metaphor, because if you have a good attitude, your window is clean. All the light can come through. You can perceive opportunities that come through the window. But if you have a bad attitude, negative attitude, you're constantly sulking at how negative things are, the bad things that are happening in life. You're not grateful. You have a cloggy window. And even though the same light is outside as when you have the clear window, you can't see the opportunities that are right in front of you because of the clogged window. So what's a concrete example of this positive attitude coming out in practice? Well, I'll tell you a concrete example. Literally just happened today, right before this freaking podcast. Dumb. Which is, I was walking outside and dropped my phone like a foot. It's like the smallest drop you've ever seen. Like, but look at this Bivachon right here. Yeah, the podcast viewers can't see. It's not looking too hot. And as you can tell, I'm still smiling and happy. And you know why that is? Because I'm talking to my brother on a podcast across the world, getting to discuss attitude together, laugh, and all this other stuff. So I still want to have a positive attitude because I know that having this positive attitude is going to ripple into you and hopefully make your studying for all these tests better later on, right? That's why I continue. Like, I don't feel as positive as I am right now because I'm like, oh, my phone. But I continue to want to show that because I know that it will help other people have a better attitude. So it ripples out. So that's the last thing I'll say before stop is, like, that's a big reason I think Cornell students are, a lot of Cornell students are actually self-destructive, because there's this culture at Cornell of complaining, of trying to flex how little sleep you've gotten, how much homework you're doing, how hard you're working onto other students. It's a weird flex. Sky, I'm telling you, there are some weird conversations I've listened into. Like, imagine sitting at a coffee shop. Actually, don't even imagine. This is literally what happened a week ago. I was sitting at a coffee shop, two people sitting next to me, both talking about a
friends you're listening up. In, or they're your acquaintances?
I don't know these people. I'm just okay, listening.
You're in. Listening in. All right.
Yeah, listening in. One of them's like, oh man, dude, I got four prelims this week, like an essay due 2 hours from now. And the other one's like, really? I got five essays due this week and next week. And the other guy's like, yeah, I didn't get any sleep last night.
I'll do you one better.
I haven't slept
in a year.
I haven't slept in a year. And then the other guy's like, really? I've been addicted to meth, cocaine, marijuana for the last 10 years.
Okay.
You know what? And he didn't actually say that, but it basically was just like a one-up game over and over again. It was incredible. And
well, I studied the reason, 17 hours. Well,
17 I, hours. Okay, I studied 36 hours yesterday, straight, and there's only 24 Bull. Hours in the day. And it's like, what?
Daylight savings. I got
daylight savings. Exactly. So the reason this is so insidious is because the words you tell yourself, the stories you tell yourself, the attitude you have, they actually impact how you perceive your situation, right? If you tell yourself, oh, life sucks, I have so much to study for, I'm working so hard, you know what's going to happen? Life's actually going to suck because you're telling yourself that. So ironically, if these students weren't as negative in their attitude about the classwork, they would probably be doing better. And I'm not saying that you should always have a positive attitude and never, like, show your negative emotion. What I am saying is that most people could have a little bit more positive of an attitude more of the time, because they're actually self-destructive by having such a negative attitude.
Gather around the campfire. It is summary time. I hope you enjoy. So you are saying that our attitude affects, first of all, ourselves, but also the people around us. And you started with the example of you dropped your phone, which for the podcast viewers was absolutely obliterated. So it was in a very bad place.
It doesn't but look good.
That I'm having a rough time with studying, and even if I wasn't, you still want to have a positive effect on my attitude. And by you being positive, it ripples out to your relationships, and it makes their lives better, and it's overall a positive effect on them. So you feel it's almost your responsibility to be positive so that other people's lives are better. And that would be one general mindset you can have. Like, your attitude is going to make someone else's day that much better. So that's why you have a good attitude. And then you talked about the strange Cornell flex culture. I worked harder. No, I worked. And you're saying that is almost a downward spiral.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what you tell yourself becomes true. If you say, oh, I have so much work, it's going to be terrible. I have five exams and a prelim. You're just going to slowly enter into Dante's Inferno.
Yeah.
Down the spiral. So I understand the ripple mindset. That is, you know, my attitude has an effect on other people. since I'm in the same predicament as the Cornell students at this moment, of I have an exam and it's going to be miserable. I'm already doing it. my bad. what can I do to adjust my mindset? The exams are in 1 week. From what I can tell, I have to study for pretty much the whole day until then. How can I adjust my mindset?
That
besides the Ripple technique.
Phenomenal question. So there's a few things that I think can help you get through this period. The first is
weed. Go on. Yeah. I'm in the Netherlands.
Just the one word answer was so funny. The first is reframing what studying for this exam is, what goals it's helping you towards. So right now, the frame that you have, it sounds like, is, oh, God dang, I'm going to have to study for hours for this exam that I don't really care about.
Yep.
Like, this sounds horrible, right? The frame you have doesn't point towards a higher order goal that you actually care about. So the first thing you can do is reframe. How can you connect this to a higher order goal in your life that you do care about? For example, you could say, I'm super passionate about acting, but I know it's difficult to make that a financial, my single financial provider. So doing these tests is going to help me get a degree that might be able to make me enough money to do acting as my passion for most of the time. That's a reframe right there. Mm-hmm. Another reframe is, I'm a big believer in prioritizing long-term gratification over short-term. Doing this is going to train my ability to do things I don't want to, which will help me do more things I don't want to in the future that help me become the person I want to become.
That was actually what you just said is the current philosophy.
The current philosophy. Yeah. Which I think is a pretty darn good one. There's other goals that you could connect to outside of that. Those are just two examples that I'm going to give you. So that's the first thing, is like reframe why you're doing this. A second thing that I think I used to think was super wah, wah, wee, wah, but I recommend you now do, is visualize what it would be like to fulfill the goal that you are aiming for. I used to think this was super wobble. Like, you know, like the self-improvement literature where it's like, visualize what it's going to be like when you have your goal. Like, yeah, just see yourself. And I was like, what? That's so stupid. Like, why would I do that? Why would I not just like do the goal? And then I realized that your brain, when you visualize yourself doing something, the same parts of your brain are activated as when you actually do that thing. The only difference is that your basal ganglia, you don't have to know what that is, it's just deactivated, which means you don't actually do the movements associated with doing that thing. So what that means...
Sure. I think you do micro movements. Like, even for example, when you're reading a book and you're, you know, reading in a more sophisticated language, I'm pretty sure your tongue makes micro movements as if it's mimicking. As in, when you visualize, I know you don't actually go through the process of, you know, taking the test and everything, but I think in a tiny way, I'm not a scientist, but I think the body makes these micro movements as if it were trying to do it, but not fully, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you might be right. But in any case, I hope when you're reading, you don't full on like Kaladin storms, picked up the bridge on his back. And you're just like, while you're reading, you're just like,
I can feel, when I'm reading, I can feel my tongue move sometimes, even though I'm not trying to talk. It's as if it's, you know, adjusting to be able to read those words.
That's cool. Yeah, maybe you do some micro movements, but that kind that even more like points to the point that I'm about to make, which is visualizing yourself completing your goal allows you to leverage what I call psychological energy for your present self to strive towards that goal. Because think about it like this. You imagine yourself, you visualize yourself completing that goal. Like, what does it feel like? What does it look like? What smells are going through your mouth? Like, what does it taste like? Like, just any sensation you can bring to finishing that goal. Your brain thinks you're actually doing that because it doesn't, the same parts of your brain are activated as if you were. And then you get to take some energy from you thinking that that's actually happened, and you get to use it in the present. A concrete example of how I've done this is I would love 3 years from now to have a studio apartment with a recording studio for content creation, and in that recording studio to have Stoic decorations as well as Stormlight Archives decorations, right? Very nice. So like podcast mic, shotgun mic, just all the good stuff, right? Soundproof walls.
Oh, you want like marble statues?
I think a little Marcus Aurelius statue that's like Marcus Aurelius, right? Okay. Yeah. And then in the subsequent room, I visualize one half big personal library, whole bunch of physical books, and the other half board game closet. And in the middle, there's a whole bunch of chairs that you can sit in to read and a table to play board games on. And then finally, there's no bedroom in the house. I sleep on the floor like a buffoon. I'm joking. The bedroom's just not part of the visualization. Then there's a kitchen area where there is food being cooked, and there's a peanut butter cabinet with peanut butter and nut butters in it.
Of course.
But there's also fresh baked oatmeal in one of the little like oatmeal cookers. And very specific. I make it very specific so that I can visualize it as well as I can. Every time I sit down to like write or to do some deep work, I go through this visualization for like a minute. And that helps give me energy in the moment to do the hard thing even when I don't feel like it. So I leverage psychological energy. So those are my two tips to you for this studying, is reframe your problems and then also create your own visualization and use it to give you a better attitude in the present.
Okay. Do we continue or do I set up a campfire for summarization time?
I think set up a campfire.
All right, gather around. Bring a marshmallow, bring some s'mores, some chocolate. It's summarization time, folks. So you just gave us two more techniques to improve our attitude in the face of adversity. The first one was replicization, which we already discussed. And now you're saying that you can reframe what the task means to you. So first of all, I know that we are in a privileged position. I know some people work in, you know, an Albert Heijn job where it's kind of menial. It's the same thing every day and it can be kind of boring, but you can say, I'm reframing this, you know, I'm providing for my family. Me going here is going to help me send my children to college. And it's going to be extremely important for that reason, for my family. Or with studying, you know, I need to become independent. And, you know, this exam's going to suck, but I see a future 2-3 years from now where I'm financially free, you know, working in some place. Then you can make it, as you said, very specific of, okay, this test will lead to me being independent with an apartment in New York with potentially a studio and a recording place and a board game. And this is venturing more into the visualization area. But in essence, you reframe the current task into what it means for you in your life. What is it going to help you achieve or accomplish? And why is this important? Is this building discipline? Because discipline has to be built. It's a task that you do, even when you don't feel like it. That's kind of the definition of discipline. So you do it even when you don't feel like it. And then with the visualization, you can really try to imagine viscerally in your mind's eye what it will look like either when the task is completed or what the completion of this task will allow you to do. So you gave us a very good example, which we don't need to go through the entire thing, but of the peanut butter and the board and the oatmeal.
The oatmeal.
Yeah. But this gives you an aim to keep in mind when the going gets tough, and it reminds you of why you're doing it in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, your campfire summaries are the best. I love... I'm just imagining another visualization.
Oh, your hands in the fire.
Yeah, I was so confused for a second. I was like, what? I'm just imagining myself as you're summarizing, just cooking a s'more and then eating it. It's just great. Now, I have a question for the second half of this podcast that I think you will be able to give a lot of perspective to and also stories about. And that is a big part of attitude that we haven't discussed is how your characteristic attitude gets built in the first place. Like, why do people tend to have the attitude they do, right? And I think a large part of it comes from childhood and the experiences that we have throughout childhood and young adulthood that shape the characteristic feelings, thoughts, beliefs, behaviors, and therefore outcomes that we have, which can be positive and can be negative. It can be negative in that it creates limiting beliefs. So I think you would have a lot of interesting stuff to say because you've pointed outside of the podcast about your interest in limiting beliefs and how you have tried or are trying to overcome some of those limiting beliefs right now.
I'm confused exactly how I'm supposed to respond. I think you're saying, how does early childhood affect how you grow up? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think what would be interesting is if you talked about some of the limiting beliefs that you developed through childhood and how you're trying to overcome them now and tie it back into attitude.
Well, this is quite personal to share on the podcast.
I mean,
do I feel comfortable? I think I do. I think I do feel comfortable. This is a safe space.
It's a safe space. This is a campfire. We have a nice campfire.
I believe from reading many books, from reading David Goggins, from watching Alex Ramosi, from, you know, consuming countless podcasts, that negative emotions are more of a driving force than positive emotions. I'll explain what I mean by that. So let's imagine that someone wants to become successful and rich and wealthy, as many of us do. One way to look at this is, oh, it would be really nice if I were rich, because then I could buy a steak at a restaurant. Because, you know, the steak is 35 euros and it's expensive. And it would taste really good to eat that steak. And it would be nice to have an apartment. And these are kind of positive things that would propel you towards something. Or it'd be nice to have an 8-sleep bed. My pillows aren't nice and, you know, a bed would be nice to have. That's good. And then another way to look at this is through negative emotions. So when I see someone who has a meal I can't afford, I feel insecure. When I see someone who's more charismatic than me, I feel insecure about my own level of charisma. When I see someone who's funny, I feel insecure because they have something I don't have. And I wish I were as free in conversation as they were. And I feel like I'm not enough. Or when I see someone who is good at art or craft or, you know, good at their profession, I'm like, oh, he's so much more knowledgeable than me. And I feel kind of insecure. And I believe that myself and the majority of society is deeply insecure about many, many things. And I think that these negative emotions of I'm not good enough, or I have a past trauma, or I was rejected when I was 12 years old by a girl, and I want to build myself up into a man that can no longer be rejected because it's just, you know, I'm that much of a man. Or I had, this isn't me specifically, but, you know, I had someone die in my past, and the pain of this loss is motivating me to, you know, really try and be present in every moment because it all might go away because I'm so terrified that I might lose another person and I need to be there while they're still here. So I think that these negative emotions are much more of a driving force. We saw this in, first of all, Tim Ferriss's podcast, his TEDx talk about fear setting. How, you know, psychologists have tried to motivate people with the positive stuff. Your life would be better if you worked harder for this, this, and this reason. But what seems to be more effective, I don't have a clinical research paper to reference, but what seems to be more effective is to say, if you don't work as hard as you can, then 5 years from now, you'll be in the same place and you'll live the same life that you're currently living, and you won't be able to do the things you dream of doing, and nothing will change. And the fear of things remaining the same is more motivating than the potential gain of things being nice. So in regards to your childhood question, I guess I would say that throughout high school, I was rejected by, I was very picky, but I was rejected by two girls in the Pacific. And that has been, a driving force in my motivation to become unrejectable in a certain sense, which actually has worked out quite well. And then I used that as a fuel source. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with using negative emotions as a fuel source or something to escape from. Like if you grew up in extreme poverty, I've actually always been jealous of people who lived off or they grew up in a worse scenario than I have. Because, I mean, this is, of course, a twisted way of seeing it because I didn't actually live a worse upbringing. But to me, they have more motivation. They have unlimited drive because they're coming from a darker place. It's like the classic story of Eminem. Like the reason he is so successful is because he was jumped as a kid and his childhood was so fucked up. That's the fuel. That's where the energy comes from in his music. So I've always been somewhat jealous, which I know is a twisted way of looking at it and it's not the full picture. But yeah, I see these negative emotions as nothing wrong with them, but utilize them and use that as fuel. So like right now, for example, the pain of, first of all, having to pay the Dutch government back for if I don't graduate, and also the pain of, you know, being dependent on someone else for my own freedom, that pain I want to avoid, and I want to become, you know, self-sufficient. So I want to avoid that pain, and that's been the driving factor. Rather than, oh, it'd be nice to be independent, it's more like it sucks that I have to rely on someone else, or it sucks that I'm not as free as I want to be. Overall, I think traumas are extremely, you know, a driving force. If you read both of David Goggins' books, for example, part of the reason I would consider him the hardest man on earth, physically and mentally, but his childhood was messed up and he wanted to escape that. He thought he was a loser. He thought he was a nobody. He thought, you know, I'm never going to amount to anything. Bad education, the only black kid in a neighborhood that has a KKK group. People write the N-word on his car. You know, white kids pull out a gun on him when he's, you know, growing up as a teenager. He has a abusive dad, and then, you know, they break away from that, and then he gets a stepdad who's good for him, and he's a kind, loving person, but that stepdad gets shot. And the second his life is about to be, you know, getting better, that's taken away from him. And all these things kind of pile up. He's like, I'm uneducated. No one likes me. I'm always the person who, you know, is outside. And then you've got two options here. You can stay with that negative emotion, or you can try and change it. And he used it as a fuel source. It took, of course, a little bit. I think he really, you know, kind of began the self-actualization around 24 years of age. It took a while. That pain had to kind of boil and brood. But then he changed his life and became, you know, a motivational speaker with all these world records, Navy SEAL, a celebrated military degree, changed millions of lives, written all these books. But I would say the primary fuel source was negative emotions. And I think it probably still is. So in regards to your question, I think trauma and negative emotions are extremely motivating. And yeah, I guess if we're going to relate it back, it can help you have a positive attitude, because seeing negative emotions as negative, that's just one way of interpreting it. You can also see it as infinite fuel. You can also see it as, you know, my traumas made me who I am. Without them, I could not be as great, or I would not have had the fuel or the courage or the motivation to propel myself to where I am. That's a long-winded answer to your question.
No, that was a great answer. So when you're visualizing your goals 10 years from now, instead of visualizing the positive like studio that you want to see, you visualize yourself not being able to afford chocolate when you go to the store. And yeah, that fear of like, no, you're like, that gives you fuel in the moment.
Not chocolate per se, but yeah.
No, I was joking. Obviously no, not
to
chocolate.
To a certain degree, yeah. But yeah. Just, you know, not being free, the pain of, okay, what if nothing changed? What if my life was the same?
Yeah. It sounds like one of the big points that you want to make is negative emotions are not necessarily bad. It depends upon how you frame them. Yeah. And we tend to see negative emotions as exactly that, negative. But while they can be bad sometimes, in that you feel them not because there is something actually wrong in reality, but because there is something wrong with how you're seeing the situation, they can also be indicative of, we genuinely should change something we're doing in life because we're doing something wrong. Like the reason a lot of people that have anxiety or depressed are so because of a reason. Like they should change their life. There's a reason that you feel that way, not every single time, but a lot of the time, right?
I guess, in response to what you're saying, I gave kind of a life philosophy without concrete examples. So like, okay, I feel like I'm not funny enough. Okay, boom, took a stand-up comedy course, increased, you know, how funny I am.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not charismatic enough. Okay, read How to Win Friends and Influence People, read 3 other books, watched 100 podcasts. Okay, now I feel pretty comfortable. Oh, I feel like, you know, my body isn't the way I want it to look. Okay, gym. You know, these negative emotions directly result in you changing it.
Yeah.
So you kind of have 2 options here. Like you feel a negative emotion, you can either remove the desire, which is extremely difficult. Like it's very hard. You know, I don't have enough. I feel, you know, insecure about my body. You can do enough psychological work to, you know, think it's not important how you look, or you can just, you know, go through the pain of the gym.
Yeah.
Pain of the gym, or the pain of, you know, a good habit, or yeah. But you have a negative emotion, then you fix it. Oh, I feel like I can't get girls. Okay. You got to do cold approaches. You got to go on dates. And then, okay, you know, I solved that. So these negative emotions are almost a compass, which is, you know, okay, this feels bad. Let me alleviate this pain, not by ignoring it, but by solving it through X.
Mm-hmm. I agree. The power of negative emotions can often overcome positive ones because humans have a negativity dominance. We've evolved to have a negativity dominance, right? Like, as hunter-gatherers, what information is more important? The fact that there is an excess amount of berries in one area that you can go and grab, or that there's a tiger 20 feet away that's about to murk you and you might die, right? You're going to prioritize the information about the tiger because that might kill you. The one caveat I would say is I do think there is a trap that you can fall into if you motivate yourself through negative emotions in the wrong way. And I'm trying to figure out how to formulate this in words, but I think I'll give an example instead, in the wrong way, in my opinion, to use negative emotions. And that is how Alex Hormozi used it to fuel his beginning success. Is he fueled himself off of his hatred for his father for like 5 years. And it was only after those 5 years that he was able to forgive his father I should be more concrete in how he fueled himself. So his father didn't believe that he could start a business. He wanted him to become a successful lawyer and in college. So Alex Hormozi did that for a while. He like played the whole college game, tried to get super good grades, but he didn't enjoy it. He wanted to become a business person. And his father was like, no, it's not going to work. And he was also, I can't remember exactly. I don't think he treated him well as a kid either. And Alex Hormozi was spiteful about that. So Alex Hormozi eventually tried to start a business. And the entire time his father's like, this is going to work. Like, you're a disgrace. And he used his hatred for his father to fuel his building his business for 5 years. And to me, the reason that's bad is it's the root of him building his business. The core of it was not to help others, but rather to escape, to prove his father wrong. And something about that gives a really bad taste in my mouth. Like, if you're gonna, if you're gonna build a business and make money off of other people, it should be at its root about helping others, not proving your father wrong because he didn't believe in you.
I think we grew up with very loving parents, and I have heard so many stories of just the terrible childhood some people have. First of all, what I just said about David Goggins, also with, I've heard, you know, people I know who, you know, they as a kid made their parents unhappy, and the parents just kicked them out of the house. Okay, you can't sleep here tonight. Figure it out. Do your thing. Or, and I guess it's stereotypical, but it's the stories I've heard, you know, some Asian parents, they force their kid. They have all these expectations. You got to do this, 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 work, do this. No, only path is this. You can only do that. And then so many people, they just want to prove that wrong. They feel constrained. They feel constricted like a python, like their parents' expectations are slowly choking them. And they need to escape that. And, you know, first of all, Alex Hormozi is quite young. And I think you have a certain degree of leeway when you're young. Because, you know, when you're young, you want to build your own life. You want to be independent. You want to escape these childhood traumas and insecurities. You want to prove your parents wrong. And I think that as you age and you feel more secure and you climb higher up in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you naturally become more giving. Like, you've seen how Alex Hormozi has switched to a very giving mindset, but I think he almost had to go through that phase where he breaks the expectations of his father, and he breaks and he forms his own identity. And that was almost needed because of that overarching figure. And then after you do that, then you can become very giving. It's the same way if you look at like Arnold Schwarzenegger's, if you look at his trajectory, you know, right now he's a very, I think, giving person. He's, you know, a public servant. He was the governor of California. He transformed a bunch of physical programs. He's, you know, done a bunch of environmental work. He's very giving, a bunch of charity work. But early on in the career, I would argue that there was quite a few selfish motives, like, with, I want people to see me as, you know, the biggest, the strongest, with movies. The way he went about it, I saw some degree of he wanted vanity and for selfish purposes. But I think it switched. So I think it's fine to have some leeway at the beginning where you need to do things for yourself. And then as you climb higher and you feel more secure and you self-actualize, then it kind of naturally transitions. Like, you take a happy person, they help other people. You take an unhappy person, they try and, you know, seek out stuff for themselves. So I think he kind of needed that. I think that was part of the journey. And I don't know if there was another way. Like, that was the primary fuel source.
I think you're giving examples of cases where fueling yourself in that way has led to the ability to be kind later in life. Yeah. But there's also examples of the opposite, where somebody has a negative childhood, still fuels himself off of being kind to people, and is able to do it the entire way. And like Keanu Reeves, for instance, man is a gem. literally his entire life, even though his childhood wasn't the best. And I think just because there are examples of people that have fueled themselves in that way and then have become kind isn't a valid argument in itself to say that that's okay.
Okay, fair.
But I do think you have a point that when your survival needs are not met, it's hard to focus on self-actualization entirely. That doesn't mean it's impossible to self-actualize without your survival needs met, but it is a lot harder. So I do think a certain degree of fuel from negative emotions is needed when you haven't met those survival needs. But I do still think that at the root, you should be fueled by helping others. Because if you're building a business, that should be the very core of why you're building. Otherwise, I mean, what's the point of building a business if you're just adding another one of those, if you're just adding another corrupt business in the world that gets people to buy shit they don't need and do stuff that they don't need. Like, I don't want to do that. That sounds horrible. And yet that's what a ton of big businesses out there are. How do you think the owner of a lot of the tobacco companies out there see themselves? Like, what is fueling them to continue selling these tobacco products to people knowing how bad it is?
Well, from what I can tell, I think people very rarely see themselves as the bad guys. They find a way to make them, even serial killers see themselves as good, not good people, but they rationalize it. Mm-hmm. They're like, humanity is a plague. I am helping cure the world by killing these people. Or they find a way, or like the tobacco company, you know, this causes cancer, but you know, I'm using this money to send to this charity. So it balances out. So, as in, I don't think people, they try to rationalize a way to make them seem good. It's very common.
Yeah.
It's hard to find someone who does evil things and believes they're evil.
And believes they're evil. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Even, what is it? Who's the drug lord? Al Capone?
Yep.
Yeah. He said, why are people after me? I think it was like some kind of quote. This is paraphrasing, where he's like, all I do is give people simple pleasures and they want to lock me up. That's kind of how he saw it.
Yeah.
He's like, it's their choice. I'm providing them with the drug. It's their choice. They rationalize. That was just a slight tangent in terms
of psychology. That was a funny example. Yeah. No, it's an interesting idea.
I get what you're saying. A company should be good for people.
Yes, like for that. People.
I approve like of this message.
You approve of this message? It's good.
Hey, good job.
Thank you. So tying back to limiting beliefs, it sounds like you're saying through action, studying how to become funnier because you felt you were inept at funny, studying how to become more desirable in dating because you felt like those two experiences earlier on fueled you. Those were what fueled you. You're breaking past these limiting beliefs that you have for yourself.
Yeah.
What limiting beliefs are you trying to break past right now?
The main one, I'm a very clever person. And by that, I mean the self-deception is unreal. It's truly incredible, the amount of self-deception. So perfectionism, I guess, would be the main one. So I had a YouTube channel, or I have a YouTube channel, and I have uploaded, I think, 45 videos at this point. And currently, I am working on a video. This is true.
The Matrix one.
I am working on a video, which is going to take a long time. I think probably 100 hours in total. Which I think is a convenient way to, I can't upload because, you know, this is true. I am working on the video. That's not a lie. I am. But because I chose this long one and I want it to be so good, it's giving me leeway to not upload when I think the true fear is to upload something of low quality. It's the perfectionist mindset coming in a unique way. It's like, oh yeah, well, you are making YouTube videos. You are. That's a fact. I am working on the video. Mm-hmm. But it's in reality, I could be uploading a short, just record like a similar to the hour long video you did, Happiness.
Yeah.
I could record that. After this podcast, I could do that. But I'm actively deceiving myself and saying, yeah, I mean, you are working on a video. you are. But I'm actually just hiding because I'm scared of uploading consistently when I can't, you know, determine the quality or I feel insecure about the quality. So it's a cope. It's a cope. Mm-hmm. So I guess working on the perfectionist mindset, and that would be the number one thing that the things I do are interesting enough. I guess it's even in acting class, I try to do, you know, show this, do that. Be interesting. When in reality, you could look at someone walking down the street and they're doing nothing special, but you can tell a million things just based on how they walk. Mm-hmm. Are they looking down? You can tell within half a second of looking at someone kind of how they're feeling. Are they sad, depressed, hopeful, anxious? And they don't have to be doing anything interesting. They don't have to be, you know, I guess jumping up and down or doing this crazy movement. You can tell so much with just a look. If you watch a movie with a professional actor, an Oscar winner, you know, there's 15, 30 second scenes where they're just staring at the camera. Are you bored? No. So I guess the number one limiting belief I'm working on right now is trying to, you know, work on the perfectionism and trying to work on the, I guess, coming at life with a you are enough mindset more so.
Yeah.
And working through the self-deception, which is with this video, I am making the video, but I could be doing other things.
Yeah.
I could be producing videos while I'm working on the big one.
Yeah.
But I'm not.
Dude, thanks for sharing that. That was really deep. And I'll share with you a limiting belief that I'm working through, but I have one question before that. And that is, why do you think you are so scared of uploading a video that is of lower quality?
I don't know if I could put it into words. And I don't know if there's a good reason. I don't think there is. I guess one of the major things would be, it feels weird to tell people what to do. Like I have some ideas of, you know, mindset videos of, what's it called? Like Eat the Frog video. So like if you're, this is not important, but I have some ideas, but in those videos, I'm kind of telling people how to live, or I'm telling people what to do. Like with your PKM, you're telling someone, this is how you should use your personal knowledge management system, which is a lot of, I guess, it feels weird to tell someone else how to live their life when I don't feel like an expert. Mm-hmm. The same thing with the acting videos. I know a lot about acting now. I know a lot. I read, you know, several books, I've been taking classes, but at the same time, I feel quite new and I want to make acting videos, but I also feel like I'm not qualified. Like what gives me the right to tell people what acting is when I, you know, I'm not that trained yet.
Yeah. Do you want advice or you just want to say?
Yeah.
In
regards to acting videos.
In regards to acting videos specifically, this is something I struggled with as well when I started making videos about productivity, task, time management, how to read more effectively, PKM.
What gives you the right?
Yeah, what gives me the right, right? I'm not an expert. Want to hear the simple truth? The very fact that you aren't an expert is what gives you the right. Because guess what? 99% of people in the world are beginners. And therefore, you have a vast market to appeal to by being a beginner going towards the intermediate stage yourself. it's very unrelatable to only watch videos by experts, because the experts don't understand what it's like to be a beginner anymore. They've forgotten. They can't appeal to the beginner's emotions, the thoughts, the what it actually feels like to be learning something for the first time, to be struggling through something. So I think the reason that you feel insecure about telling people to do stuff is you're thinking of yourself as the expert in the video, when what you should be thinking of yourself as is the guide. Like, this is my experience. This is what's helped me along the journey. And you don't have to do it, but I think that it will help you because it's helped me, right? Same thing with the acting. Like, do you think a 15 plus year actor is going to be able to remember what it's like to be a beginner and speak in a way that it will appeal exactly to the beginners? No, they don't remember, right? They don't truly understand the feelings the beginner's going through anymore. It's been too long. So yeah. I think that's the value that you give, is you are figuring it out with the viewer.
Okay. It's very interesting because the audience probably won't know about this, but Hams is a YouTuber, a self-improvement YouTuber, and if you look at his early videos, they're really bad. They're really, really bad. But he still kept them up, and as you just outlined, you're kind of learning along the way, and by making videos about it, you know, you first of all educate yourself because you're struggling with the material firsthand, and you're improving at a more rapid rate. But if you look at him 1 year in, like, okay, today versus 3 years ago, entirely different. And I think a huge reason that he's experienced so much growth in terms of improving himself is because, you know, he had so much hands-on experience. You know, 700 videos plus videos. If you make 700 videos, you're going to get good. Same thing with you.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, a lot of videos, so you get better. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, I wanted to share one limiting belief I'm struggling through as the end of the podcast, and that is specifically in dating, is the limiting belief that, how do I say this? It's hard to put into words. I'll just describe the difficulty, and then maybe you'll be able to put it to words. So the difficulty is like trying to be your authentic self, and trying to be my authentic self in an interaction, because on the one hand, my authentic self is I'm super geeky. I love talking about intellectual ideas, right? Like, but the problem is, like, this is the conundrum I have, is when you first, can you put it into words? Like,
so Aiden is a very interesting person. He has a bubbling personality, but he also knows exactly, because he's read books. he knows overall, generally, what girls are attracted to, and he feels like there's a slight gap. So he wants to portray an image of himself that he thinks has a higher success rate of attracting someone. But given enough time, he knows that he wants to be his authentic self, but he thinks that that might be less likely to be attractive.
So you
portray a certain personality.
Nailed it. This is the conundrum that I have, is when I'm talking to women, I know that my authentic personality is not very romantic, not very like flirtatious, right? Mm-hmm. It's more like a mix of energy from, like, you know, energy and positivity, and like, yeah, let's go do something fun. Like, let's go hiking, or let's go like canoeing, or like backpacking. Mm-hmm. And then also like, oh, you know, there's an interesting idea that I read about in this book a couple of days ago. Oh, and I listened to you on this podcast. Would you like to talk about that idea? And neither of those are the same, like, flirtatious, romantic thing that might be attractive to a woman on first interaction. And that's the conundrum I have, is like, do I show my authentic self right away, or do I like create this little like personality for myself of being super flirtatious and not talk as much about ideas, and then slowly bring that in? But the problem is, if I slowly bring that in and then they're not into that, then like I've spent all this time with this person that's not into that, and now like, you know, I don't want to keep that relationship going. So do I show that off immediately? Like, do I not show that off? Like, that's my conundrum. And this limiting belief has caused such high over intellectualization and interactions, where I end up not talking to people that I would, because I'm like, oh, I can't throw my authentic self like right away. Right. Mm. Like, it feels fake, like, to do the first thing.
I'm adding some fire to the campfire.
Yeah.
Wood. I can give you a perhaps suitable response.
Yes, perhaps. Please do.
All right, we're going to look at this through the acting lens. So you just said you want to show your authentic self, which I have some issues with that word, because I think who you are changes drastically depending on who you're talking to. So yeah. We discussed this in acting with, you know, there's different versions of me. Imagine you talking to your mom. You're going to talk in a very different way than to me or a girl or a best friend or a stranger. Or the way you portray yourself in different scenarios, it's an entirely different you.
Yeah.
And then in the morning, it's a different you. In the night, on drugs, you know, doing certain activities, the you changes. And I think that in terms of a relationship, which you do you want to be? So you have this intellectual side to yourself, which is great. It's part of your personality. You can, first of all, one option is to, okay, well, I'm just going to be that intellectual person. And then, you know, I'm going to, you know, cast a net. And, you know, some girls will be attracted to that and they'll come in. But you're right now thinking, you know, not every girl will be attracted to that. What is the relationship? Which of you do you want to be in the relationship? Do you want it to only be, okay, we're going to do fun and games, it's going to be romantic? Or do you want your partner, in terms of women, to be an intellectual partner? Or should it just be an adventuring partner? Or should it just be, oh, we're a creative couple. What we do is creative things. That's what holds the relationship together. We do physical things together. Like, there's so many different ways that you can mm-hmm. approach the relationship of who do you want to be in the relationship. It doesn't yeah. have to be the full you, because when you make it the full you, it makes it unromantic. It's like, you know, the person you're in a relationship with doesn't have to be the same person you do your schoolwork and your taxes and your homework and your budget. And you don't need to show them your entire life. It's not, you don't have to show them everything, at least from my perspective. They can be one thing. For me, with women, you know, this is the fun part. We're not doing anything work. We're having fun. We're making jokes. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it. That's what I choose to be in the relationship. I actually don't talk about intellectual ideas with women, not very much, because to me it's, okay, we're now in fun mode. We're having fun now.
Mm-hmm.
We're being creative now. And I would, you know, we talk about intellectual things. Very rarely would I discuss topics like what we're doing in this podcast now with a girl. It just wouldn't normally happen. But that's a choice I made, because I'm like, okay, I want to have fun now. So yeah. You get to choose different, you can portray yourself in different ways. That's an option to you. And I don't see that as disingenuous. Like, we are all different people at different times.
Mm.
You swap out masks. Swap out personalities. The way I, you know, it's interesting, because one of the people in my acting class has seen different personas of mine. And they're like, what? So you get to choose the persona. You get to choose what the relationship is.
Yeah.
And if you want to go the intellectual route, you can do that. And if you want to go the playful route, you can do that. And at the end of the day, you know, you don't have to show them the full package.
Yeah.
You can show them what you want the relationship to be.
That is profound. Thank you. Like, I resonate a lot with what you're saying in regards to authenticity, because that word is thrown around so often nowadays. We're like, be your authentic self. But you're right, you do change depending upon the situation, and I really, depending upon the context. And I really respect your choice of, you know, the type of girl you want to be with is one you can be mostly fun around. Like, it's fun time. And you've made me realize that I know this is going to make, this is why I think it's going to make finding an actual relationship harder, a long-term relationship at least. But from my last relationship, I know I want to be able to do both. I want to be able to do both the fun and games and the intellectual talk, because I know it's possible. It was possible in my last relationship. We got both fun and games and the intellectual talk. I know it's possible because John, his girlfriend right now, can do both. So I know it's possible, but it's harder. So
yep.
I think the thing that I'll have to accept knowing this is it's just going to take longer to find someone that can do both of those, because you're asking more of the person that you're with. And I just have to suck it up and realize worthwhile things take time. It takes hard work, just like any other worthwhile thing. And that's going to apply to this as well.
I guess one last thing. So you're, you know, choosing to have the relationship that's intellectual as well as fun. People pick up on intention. No matter what you do, like, I guess we pick up on these subtle cues. So if you think, oh, she's not going to like it if I, you know, talk about intellectual things, or, oh, she's not going to like it if I, you know, say this thing, somehow they'll know. And especially, I think girls are more attuned to this than we are. But if you reframe it as, you know, I want to talk about this. This is who I am. I want to be confident about it. This is a fun thing to talk about. If she doesn't like it, then, you know, I guess I'll find someone else.
Yep.
But be confident about it.
Yeah.
You're portraying your image. Don't be insecure about it. That's who you are. And there's great things about that.
Yeah.
So they're going to pick up on that confidence, and that'll be very good for you.
That is, that is great advice. Actually, I remember now that you say that, that I did try that a few days ago in one of my dates, where they asked about my YouTube channel, and I, like, as unabashedly positive as pod, just like started talking about PKM, which is not a romantic thing to talk about. But I was like, nope, I want to talk about this. I do not care. But the reason I bring that up is that is the, that has been the, for the most part, the exception, because of the limiting belief that I'm trying to get over, which is, like, when I start talking about that, like, if I started talking about Need for Cognition, right, I think until I break past this limiting belief, I would feel more insecure about talking about that, because I wouldn't know.
Yeah, but you can make it funny. You can be like, I'm a modern day megamind. I'm a hungry, hungry hippo.
I'm a hungry, hungry hippo. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Most people eat food, but I just devour knowledge.
I just devour knowledge.
You can make it funny.
You can. Yeah, I like that. This has been a good podcast. Do you think we should do a quick like 1 minute summary of everything we talked
campfire,
about?
Campfire.
Yeah, campfire. So today we learned attitude profoundly affects your outcomes in life. And the reason I'm so positive most of the time, even if I don't feel it on the inside all the time,
no electrons.
Is because I want to ripple it out to others. I know that the attitude you bring to your life is profoundly effective of your outcomes. So Sky, you asked how you might be able to change your attitude towards schoolwork right now. We talked about reframing why you're doing the schoolwork and also visualizing your goals being met. You talked about the power of negative emotions and motivation. And we also talked about limiting beliefs and how to break through them. Is there anything else you want to add?
Nope.
Yeah. Phenomenal. We'll see you guys in the next one. Thank you for watching.